And I'm here to talk to you about an intervention that I took part in for 4 years. And I'm not going to throw a bunch of data at you. I've done that already. We're working on that. I just want to talk to you about the experiences that we had in working with such a hidden and vulnerable population. So I have no financial relationships to disclose. So I'm sure I'm speaking to an audience that's aware of this, but significant disparities exist in HIV/AIDS. Across all groups and subgroups, black MSM, or men who have sex with men, have been deemed by the CDC as bearing the greatest disproportionate burden of HIV. In fact, between 2006 and 2009, rates of new HIV infection among young black MSM increased by 48%. And this is significant since rates among most other groups have either stayed the same or even decreased. Another unique subpopulation that's garnered a lot of attention is men who have sex with men and women, or MSMW. This group is particularly relevant among blacks, as black MSM are more likely than MSM of other races and ethnicities to be either behaviorally bisexual or to identify with a bisexual label. More specifically, in terms of HIV, a study that was carried out in Los Angeles County at public STD clinics found that non-Hispanic black MSMW were found to have the odds of being infected with HIV that were 30 times greater than the heterosexual men in the sample. So with such a glaring disparity in HIV, it's become increasingly important that we look at efforts that explore risk factors other than what we've looked at in the past among these diverse populations. So one important variable, experiences of childhood sexual abuse, or CSA, has commonly been neglected in much of the research, despite several studies actually having linked the history of CSA to a number of negative physical, mental, and sexual health outcomes. So in this study, we defined CSA as, before the age of 18, a person experienced any unwanted or forced sexual contact, so that could range from fondling or touching to intercourse, or had sexual experiences with someone who was at least 5 years older than them. And this definition is consistent with the literature. However, it's important to note that CSA prevalence rates among males vary greatly. In fact, some large national scale studies have found, have reported prevalence rates anywhere between 4% all the way up to 76%. So this large range in CSA rates may be so wide due in part to the difficulties inherent in assessing CSA among men, or the different ways in which CSA is assessed and conceptualized or operationalized in different studies. So I'll give you a little background information on the intervention that I'll be talking to you about today. It was a randomized controlled trial that addressed HIV and CSA among HIV-positive black MSMW, and it took place between 2007 and 2011. The project was called the Enhanced Sexual Health Intervention for Men, or the ESHIM Project, and it was an HIV risk reduction and stress reduction intervention. The principal investigator was Dr. John K. Williams, who's from the Department of Psychiatry and Biobehavioral Sciences at UCLA, and I served as the project director from start to finish. We also had two facilitators who served as data collectors and a recruiter. So just a really brief overview of the inclusion criteria for the sample. They were really specific eligibility criteria. They had to identify as black or African American, speak English, be at least 18 years of age or older. They also had to be HIV positive and had to have been positive for at least 2 months prior to enrollment. And we actually verified status by looking at diagnosis forms, viral load, CD4 counts, or some sort of HIV medication prescription. They had to be behaviorally bisexual with both a male and female partner in the previous 3 months, have engaged in some sort of unprotected sexual activity in the previous 3 months, have a history of childhood sexual abuse, and not identify with the gay label. So despite these incredibly specific criteria, we did manage to recruit 117 participants into the baseline, and this went to 88 people who took part in the intervention. That was 44 per condition. So just a really quick look at the sample. The vast majority had a high school education or less. Almost 3/4 of the sample were unemployed or were unable to work due to disability. It was a very low income sample, with 63% making $12,500 or less per year. And despite being behaviorally bisexual, almost three quarters had never been married, which also meant that 25% had been married at some point. So to give you just a little bit of background information on the intervention, there were two conditions. There was ESHM, which was the intervention condition, and the control condition, which we called health promotion, or HP. So ESHM focused on HIV transmission reduction, addressed the impact of the triple stigma, which was the intersection of homophobia, racism, and being HIV positive and its impact on current sexual behavior. We discussed histories of childhood sexual abuse and how that impacted current risk behavior, and we also talked about reducing stress. The main aims of the ESHM intervention were to reduce unprotected sex, as well as decrease symptoms of depression and post-traumatic stress disorder. Health promotion, on the other hand, did not focus at all on sexual health or on histories of CSA. Instead, it focused on general information regarding health that ranged from nutrition and physical activity to getting general medical care and medication adherence. Both of the interventions were six sessions in length, with two 120-minute sessions occurring twice per week for three consecutive weeks. We also collected data via a CASI at four different time points. That was baseline, directly after the intervention, and 3 and 6 months post-intervention. So when I came up here a couple of years ago at APHA discussing the plans for this intervention, everybody looked at me and basically said, "Are you kidding me? This is crazy. You're never going to find these people. It's impossible." And so what I want to talk about today is actually, now that we've completed the intervention, I want to address some of those initial concerns, acknowledge some of the challenges we encountered, and also offer up some recommendations if any of you are thinking of working with similar populations in the future. So first, as to be expected, of course, recruitment was indeed difficult. It wasn't impossible, but it was difficult. There was a lot of concern about the very specific eligibility criteria that we had. However, we actually found it relatively easy to locate HIV-positive black men who were behaviorally bisexual. In fact, we were able to screen 295 men, 117 of which were eligible. In addition, we actually found that most of the men we screened had a history of childhood sexual abuse. However, it's important to point out that when we were in recruitment and screening, we never directly asked our participants, "Have you been sexually abused?" Instead, we used an 8-item screener, which allowed us to capture folks who may or may not appraise their sexual abuse or early sexual experiences as abuse, so people were considered experientially or behaviorally eligible without placing a label on them. And so this, of course, made it tremendously easier for us to actually identify those with a history of CSA. On the flip side, we did find it difficult to find men who did not identify as gay. So even though all the men that we screened eligible had been behaviorally bisexual with both men and women in the past 3 months, many of the men that we screened used the gay label. So they did pick up on the fact that this is an HIV study or a study with HIV-positive men, so it could be that they thought we might be looking for gay men and kind of told us what they thought we wanted to hear. Or it could be that it just was really that much more difficult to find this particular population. Also, because it was a highly vulnerable group, we had to be particularly sensitive with our recruitment materials and messaging. So because these men are not necessarily open about their sexuality, we had to spend a lot of time developing our recruitment materials, and we could not imply any sort of sexual orientation or sexual behavior. In addition, we didn't want to deter eligible men from screening for the intervention because they were afraid of the stigma attached to their HIV status, their sexual behavior, or their history of CSA. So we didn't indicate on any of the recruitment materials that these were eligibility criteria. Overall, we just stated that we were looking for sexually active black men, and we used neutral images to, that's not up there, but the logo is very neutral in nature. We wanted to capture HIV-positive men without directly asking for them on the recruitment materials, so we really did a lot of targeted recruitment at places that served HIV-positive men. In terms of retention, we also experienced some challenges. This was a very low-income population, which is historically harder to retain in interventions. And we also experienced a lot of the men cycling in and out of incarceration, so that makes it more difficult to retain. We also found it pretty easy to screen the men, pretty easy to enroll the men, but it was really difficult getting them from enrollment into the first session. In terms of collaborating with CBOs, one of the challenges was relying on community-based organizations who were experiencing instability and a loss of funding. So we had established MOUs with four organizations, and by the end of the study, three of those agencies could no longer support us because of a loss of funding or downsizing. So because we relied on these places to both get us participants as well as to serve as sort of liaisons to the participants that had already developed rapport with these people, it made it really difficult for us to continue implementation of the intervention. And also, of course, we wanted to conduct the intervention in community spaces. And so by losing these agencies, it made it difficult for us to continue to recruit and to implement the intervention. And finally, we had one unforeseen challenge, and that was after running some initial analyses, we discovered that even though the participants were relatively homogenous in their eligibility criteria and demographics, there were still some significant differences. So we have an outcomes paper that's currently in press, so I'm embargoed from talking too much about it. But we did discover that the participants in the health promotion control condition, by chance, had higher rates of depression. And so depression was not an eligibility criterion, but we did hypothesize that it would be clinically significant considering the high level of stressors among the sample. So we did expect that both groups would sort of by randomization be similar, but we found that there were some differences which made it harder to test the effectiveness of the intervention. So in terms of some recommendations, the first and foremost is that you need to become best friends with your community-based partners. It's also important that you diversify the kinds of folks that you partner with. There's strengths and weaknesses to working with both large and smaller organizations. Larger organizations may be more financially stable, but those smaller organizations may be better at having intimate relationships with your participants. You also need to spend a considerable amount of time developing your materials so that they offer up just enough information to pique the interest of potential participants, but don't cause any anxiety based on the sensitive eligibility criteria. Also, you need to spend a lot of time getting those participants from the initial enrollment and the baseline survey into the first group session. There's no magic way to do that, but in your planning for recruitment and retention, it's important that you keep that in consideration. In terms of collaborating with CBOs, there's nothing we can do to control the economic, well, there's some things we can do to help control the economic times, but grander level things we can't really do. So what, so like I said before, we need to diversify, have relationships with places that are big, small, have all different diverse services that we can provide. You also need to have a plan A, a plan B, a plan C, a plan D, all the way down. And that's important because for us, we lost our community partners and therefore didn't have anywhere to hold the groups. But because we found it so important to develop a really good rapport with our participants, the people that were holding the intervention groups were able to bring them over to UCLA, where at least we had space, even though it may not have been the most comfortable place. So I cannot emphasize enough the importance of human interaction with your participants. And finally, in terms of study design, of course, getting a larger sample would be great. We were funded to do a smaller grant, so of course, we were successful in recruiting the folks that we wanted to, but, you know, larger sample sizes are always best. In addition to collecting larger samples, you can also stratify the sample before randomization based on conditions or factors that may be important to you. This way you can actually look at some of those intervention effects on specific groups. Furthermore, you need to realize that by screening people in just based on a common experience such as CSA, you might find that there are some differences. So for instance, CSA, we found that in our groups that there were those who kind of fell into a more lower severity group and those that were more higher severity who had experienced slightly more severe CSA. And we actually found in some of our initial analyses that those who were in the higher and lower CSA severity groups actually experienced reductions in unprotected anal intercourse in the intervention condition, but in the control condition, actually only the low severity, we found the same effect. So there's differences even within groups of those who screen in on certain eligibility criteria. So there's a lot to pack into a very brief time, but I want to thank my mentor, Dr. John K. Williams, also the UCLA Center for Culture, Trauma, and Mental Health, Disparities, NIMH, and of course my team. Thank you.